Oh man, it's been a while. We are finally cool enough cats that we can have a little bit of intro music for today's episode. Friends and neighbors, that was Muggles, as performed by Louis Armstrong and Co. Hi, my name is Ben.
My name is Noel. So we're doing a Harry Potter episode today. Right?
One would think. But in fact, we are doing something that involves what some people would call magic.
Yeah, we're talking about the reefer.
Right.
Left the jazz cigarette.
The gauge,
which was Mr. Armstrong's personal favorite slang for marijuana.
And we have had so much fun researching this legend that we were worried our better third and saving grace, super producer Casey Pegram, might actually get tired of us. But while we have him in the studio still, we are going to take advantage of that precious time.
It's really cloudy and it's like, should we open a door?
No.
Okay, cool.
Kidding. Don't engage with drugs, kids.
Don't engage with the gauge?
Yes, don't gauge. You got there.
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, man.
Yes, but our research was strictly academic for this.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%. But man, this is a cool story. There's a lot wrapped up in it. And part of it is a bit of kind of an urban legend.
Apocryphal, yeah. So we are exploring the life and times of one of the jazz greats, someone that I really enjoy, and I think you do as well, Noel. That is Louis Armstrong.
Pops.
Yes.
Satchmo.
Mm-hmm. And Louis Armstrong is known and loved the world over. He is one of those people you could rightly call an icon.
That's right. Born in 1900, August 4th, to be precise, in New Orleans, Louis. What?
He lied about his age, though, too.
Oh.
He's a very layered man.
Very much so. Cloaked in mystery. But one thing we do know is true. He grew up in a very tough neighborhood in New Orleans called the Battlefield. His father left the family when he was just a little boy, and he kind of had to fend for himself, taking on jobs. His mother apparently was only able to pay the bills through sex work.
Mm-hmm.
And he had kind of a wild upbringing in the sort of seedy underbelly of New Orleans, which included dance clubs and women of the evening, and of course, a lot of jazz musicians.
Right. His first exposure to music in a learning environment was at the Fisk School for Boys when he was about 6 years old. But he ended up putting in his time when it came to listening to music at brothels and dance halls because he had a gig selling coal for a nickel per bucket in these, in these houses of prostitution in an area called Storyville. And then as he was making his rounds delivering coal, he ran into these house musicians, and he ran into something called spasm bands.
What? I don't know about spasm bands. Tell me more.
I'm so glad you asked, Noel. A spasm band is a musical group that plays Dixieland, traditional jazz, jug band, or skiffle music.
Skiffle, like that's sort of what the Beatles were considered. They were part of the skiffle scene, apparently, in the UK. The skiffle was sort of like a folk pop kind of form of music, right?
Yeah, nailed it. Jazz, blues, folk, and American folk, known for some improvised instruments. So he, as you said, began hanging out there, spending serious time in these halls, and it was pretty apparent early on that he had a gift, a calling, a compulsion to play music, to sing, and to play the horn.
And he was taken under the wing of a Professor Peter Davis, who taught Armstrong to play the cornet, which I believe is kind of a smaller trumpet?
A trumpet is a little bit longer and more slender than a cornet, but in reality, they both play the same notes and they sound more or less the same.
I gotcha. So easy one-to-one transition from the cornet to a trumpet.
If you want to get nerdy about it, Noel,
of course I do.
The difference is mainly the way the tubing of the instrument flares. A cornet is more cone-shaped or conical than a trumpet.
So is a cornet kind of considered more bite-sized, portable? I don't know. I don't see the point.
Yeah, let us know. We are not corneticians.
No, it's true. But I am fond of some hot jazz.
Ah, yes, hot jazz, which in its day would be considered often as controversial.
Oh, yeah.
Perhaps as the use of drugs. And Louis Armstrong's jazz career is worthy of not just an episode, but an entire podcast. We could spend exploring this guy and exploring the personal struggles that he endured. I have some great Louis Armstrong facts at the end of this. But before you and I go too far down the fanboy rabbit hole, should we set the scene for today's encounter?
I think we should, Ben. I think we should.
Please, do the honors.
Today's episode centers around an apocryphal tale. I believe you used that word earlier, Ben. Mm-hmm. Apocryphal tale. Not good. It's fine. We're keeping it.
We should keep it.
Yeah. So Louis Armstrong, during the Cold War, he was made a U.S. ambassador, a goodwill ambassador. He was sent abroad, as were many African-American musicians and actors and writers, to preach equality, I guess, during the era of integration?
Well, yeah. So a goodwill ambassador isn't just relegated to this period in time. Like Angelina Jolie is a goodwill ambassador.
That's right. That's right.
They're a person who advocates typically for a country or maybe for a specific cause based on the fact that everyone knows who they are.
That's right. So Louis Armstrong had this distinction straight from the U.S. State Department, who actually also paid for or in part financed a tour that he did in Europe and Asia. And while there are a few versions of this story that sort of change where he was coming from, the one common little thread is that Louis Armstrong was at the airport after getting off a plane from one of these trips. And he was led out of line into a customs line.
Which was unusual for him because, according to the story, as a goodwill ambassador, he was traveling to different areas of the world and never having to enter customs.
And they waved him on through.
Sure.
But he was supposedly coming back from Japan. That's the most consistent version of the story that I've read. And so, yeah, he's in this line, and he starts to sweat. Why is he sweating? He's not sweating because of the sound of a hot trumpet.
Right. He's not sweating because of the heat in the airport. He is sweating because his trumpet case contains more than a beautiful musical instrument. He is, in our parlance today, riding dirty.
Riding dirty, packing.
Yeah, he has a gauge on him.
Yep, gauged up.
Yeah, he's got his muggles, slang for marijuana at the time, his left-hand cigarettes in a pretty substantial amount.
Yeah,
right?
3 pounds.
Right. That's what we hear with the story. And there's something important we want you to be aware of. As we're telling this story, you may hear us switching between different versions and different sources.
Again, quite apocryphal, bordering on urban legend. Very hard to confirm or deny this story, but there are several versions in Louis Armstrong biographies that are floating out there. So we'll give you the kind of
the bare bones
version.
Yeah. So we got off the first class flight, he's going into a customs line, and then who does he see but Richard Nixon, who was either on the way to becoming president or serving as a vice president.
Tricky Dicky.
Yep, himself. One of the men who would go on to become a huge advocate of what we call the drug war.
Yes, the war on drugs.
The war on drugs. And so in a panic and thinking quickly, Louis Armstrong, who is talking with Nixon, who turns out to be a huge fan of his.
Well, the way I've read it, too, and there's a couple versions, but Nixon sees Louis and comes running at him with open arms, thinking he's going to get a sweet press photo.
Louis
right?
Armstrong.
Satchmo, he says. He says, Satchmo. Satchmo.
Why is a living brewery?
What are you doing here?
So Louis Armstrong thinks this is a sign, and Nixon's like, oh, you know, I'm a big fan. Is there anything I could do to help you? And he says, actually, yes. You see, I'm old, and this trumpet is heavy. Do you think you could carry it for me? Give me a hand.
That was an amazing Louis Armstrong impression.
I feel like it would be racist for
exactly.
either of us
yes.
to attempt a Louis Armstrong impression.
Absolutely would, yes. But Nixon, we can do all day long.
Yeah, we could do our Muppet-level Nixons back and forth. Write in and let us know if you want us to do a show where both of us are Richard Nixon. We're ridiculous at howstuffworks.com. Oh, man, what if people write in? We'll do it if only if the episode has nothing to do with Richard Nixon.
That's fine.
Okay. You're agreed to this?
Sure.
All right. So what happens when Armstrong asks him to give him a hand?
Well, first of all, one difference in various accounts is whether he was carrying one case or two cases. I think it would make the most sense for him to have been carrying two cases because 3 pounds of weed is not going to fit into a single trumpet case.
Right. And then also asking someone to carry something for you when you have nothing else to carry seems shady.
Again, several versions. The one that we're kind of talking about here is Nixon demands that he hand him his cases because he says, a goodwilled ambassador doesn't have to go through customs, and the vice president of the United States will carry your suitcases, Satchmo.
And then again, the story, depending on when you hear it, describes a different point in Richard Nixon's career. But according to the story, according to the legend, what happens is with the maybe not the best of intentions because he clearly wanted the photo, the man who would later become Richard Nixon, a very anti-drug president, carries marijuana through customs for Louis Armstrong. Hands it back to Louis Armstrong, who somehow must have been keeping a straight face through the whole thing.
Yep.
And later, Louis and some of his accompanists will swear by this story. But the thing is, depending on who you ask, the story differs in a multitude of ways, right? First off, Armstrong was only about 12 years older than Nixon. Because he would tell people he was born on August 4th, 1900, but it was more like 1901 because it was a 13-month or so difference.
Yeah, Ben, and that particular account is credited, this is getting into murky territory here, someone named Miles.
So Miles Davis?
Oh, sure. I don't know. It's hard to say. But yeah, as it turns out, though, that keyboardist that's mentioned in that version of the story never played with Louis Armstrong.
Right.
So yeah, there's chock full of holes that
there, one. There's no record of any session where they played together. And so in that version, Armstrong was not necessarily an ambassador. He was just on a goodwill tour. And he was going to, I think they were all on the same plane and they were headed to Moscow in this thing. So the directions and the locations changed.
That's right. And this is, in what year are we talking here?
This particular, the Moscow story would date it to 1959, and that has its problems as well.
Right, but in general, like, if we're looking at a rough estimate for when this meeting was supposed to take place, it would have been late 50s, early 60s.
Right, that's about right,
Yeah, exactly. So, the Goodwill Tours, I think part of it was about integration because a lot of the people they sent on these tours were African-American luminaries. And it was meant, I think, to show, hey, we're doing good work.
Well, because one of the tenets of the Soviet ideology at the time was that communism provides much more equality than capitalism.
Oh.
So this is sort of a foray against that.
Exactly. And so it's also tied to the Cold War as well, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. At least ideologically. And so this story continues through some other iterations, right? The problem with the idea of the vice president of the U.S. taking a flight on official business to Moscow in 1959 is that there would be some sort of record of it, right? One would imagine.
Although it is true that apparently in those days, the vice president would have taken commercial flights.
Which I thought was fascinating.
Big time. I had no idea.
Like, what a kick in the pants, man.
Seriously, man.
It's the president hops on Air Force One And what do you just fist bump and then say, all right, I got to go get in line.
Got to go. Catch my flight.
And customs, of course, was a lot easier in those days.
Everything. I mean, yeah. Yeah. Gosh. Going to the airport today just stresses me out so much. It's not fun.
Furthermore, there had only been 3 trips by jazz musicians to Russia by 1971, at least that are documented.
Mm-hmm.
And Louis Armstrong was not one of those musicians.
So I'm leaning towards, if this did happen, probably coming back from his, I've seen this version of the story enough times that it seems to stick, coming back from one of his tours in Asia, in Japan, perhaps.
Yeah.
This is one of those stories, though, where it's you want to believe it because it's just so funny to think that Satchmo kind of put one over on Tricky Dick Nixon before he was even well known as being such a vehement anti-drug force, you know. But can we talk a little bit about Satchmo's lifelong love of the Mary Jane?
Yeah, let's set it up with a clip. What do you say?
Yeah, so this is a clip from Louis Armstrong on some sort of television appearance. Looks like an interview show. At first, I thought it was like Steve Allen or something, but the guy's nameplate says Mr. Daly, and I couldn't figure out what show it was. But
from 1963, right?
That's right, yes. So let's give that a listen.
Actually, I haven't had a chance to talk to Mr. Armstrong before the show, but we had a great discussion about it, and I just asked one of the folks in the show, Bob Backer, said, well, what is Louis Armstrong going to do? How's he going to disguise his voice? He says, oh, he's going way up.
This is the way he sings a song.
Is that the highest up you could get?
Well, I don't know. I'm what I'm singing, you know.
Actually, I'm afraid, Louis, that it was high for you, but it just wasn't high for the rest of them. That's all.
Well, it's all right. It's about a lot of records there.
The man that buy a lot of records.
This is worth looking up on YouTube, because without being like experts in assessing someone's mental condition or their level of intoxication, Louis Armstrong looks like he is mildly amused by this guy, or maybe smoked some pot before the show.
Yeah, the gauge.
The gauge.
That's what he called it. In fact, this clip is called Pops Loves His Pot. Because Pops was another nickname. And apparently also Louis Armstrong called everybody else Pops, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, I think that's cool.
What if I started calling everybody by my own nickname? That'd be pretty presumptuous. Also kind of badass.
Well, he probably started it before it was his nickname and people gave him that nickname.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
But, you know, I don't think that's a way to get ahead in life. You got to be a Louis Armstrong for that to work.
Did you get a sense that this very white host's being a little bit of a dick?
You know, as we were watching a lot of these interviews, one thing that bothered me and that we talked a little bit about off air is that in this time, many of the interviews that he has, especially with white interviewers, are exercises in condescension, and they're consistently talking over him and talking too much. It's strange.
Yeah, it's not cool.
It's gross.
Because the thing, like, okay, so in the company of Louis Armstrong as African-American artists who had crossover appeal, you know, to a largely white audience were people like Cab Calloway.
Sure.
And Fats Waller, for example. They all kind of had in common that they came from this kind of underground scene, Louis Armstrong in New Orleans, like we talked about at the top of the show, but they managed to break through and be very successful with white audiences, but that also, they kind of had to, like, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. It felt like they had to play by their rules a little bit. Like,
they had to sort of bow and scrape.
A little bit.
And while this may have given them success, or maybe even to some degree sanitized them or made them less dangerous to the very racist white community, it was contentious and considered offensive in the black community in the States at the time. And this is something we know now deeply troubled many of these artists, Louis Armstrong included, because he would have people in the movement, the civil rights movement, accuse him of being an Uncle Tom. The idea being that he was selling out his own identity for some measure of personal profit from people who would never respect him.
Right. Yep.
Which is a shame, because once you see his letters and his correspondence, he did have a public persona.
For sure.
That's true. Everybody does.
Yeah. No doubt about it.
But he was an activist. He came to activism. In his letters, you can see him angry, ferociously angry, and righteously fed up with the state of race relations in America, as well as the policies toward marijuana. His wife actually got arrested one time in 1954 for carrying marijuana that was allegedly his.
Yeah, it was like something in the neighborhood of like 14 grams.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a rolled up marijuana cigarette.
Yeah, it was.
I sound like a grandpa. A joint.
It was in an eyeglass case.
Yeah. And a couple of roaches.
What
they call them. Half-smoked joint.
And we have an excerpt, because he wrote a letter about this. He almost got banned from Hawaii for life.
Yeah, because this was on Waikiki.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is a letter to his then-manager, who also, I believe, had ties to the Al Capone crime syndicate.
Yeah, that's a very strange part of it. So Joe Glasser, it was his manager at the time, and because he was so incensed about this huge, what he called rigmarole,
I
love that.
Not rigmarole, mind you. Rigmarole.
Because he was so angry about this, he wrote to his manager, Joe. And we won't read the whole letter, but we have some choice excerpts here. And one of our favorites was when he said straight out, "Mr. Glasser, you must see to it that I have special permission to smoke all the reefers that I want to when I want, or I will just have to put this horn down. That is all."
That is all. He refers to the gauge as more of a medicine than a dope, he says, but he's just fed up with the penalties surrounding it. And this was not his first run-in with the law. He's actually kind of, I don't know if credited is the right word, but as being, I've seen it written, as the first celebrity arrested for marijuana possession.
Right. And he, you know, he did have his addictions. I believe he smoked 3 cigar-sized blunts a day.
A day, yeah.
And that sounds like just a maintenance thing. You know, he never had a drinking problem.
Yeah, he says he smoked the reefers instead, because he said there was no hangover, and you know, he had a lot of reasons. He had a lot of feelings about this stuff.
Right.
And he was very open about it in a way that you would not expect one to be. But I guess even in those days, if you get to a level of that kind of sacred status, you know,
sure,
as an American treasure, you can probably say what you want.
I mean, this is like Snoop Dogg, Willie Nelson level.
Big time.
And those are two very prominent advocates of marijuana today.
So that first run-in was in 1930, where he was hanging out with his drummer, a guy by the name of Vic Burton, outside the Cotton Club in Culver City, California. And lordy, 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 this quote is a delight. I'm going to read this again. Not going to do a Louis Armstrong voice. He says, "Vic and I were blasting this joint, having lots of laughs and feeling good, enjoying each other's company. Just then, 2 big healthy dicks," that means detectives, "came from behind a car nonchalantly and said to us, 'Well, take the roach, boys.'"
Yep. And that is that is a true statement. But as we have seen, it did not discourage him One bit, because one thing Louis Armstrong had was drive.
That's true. He did get put away for a handful of days. He could have gotten 6 months, but he and the drummer were, I think, fined $1,000 a piece in 1930.
Which is insane.
Shall we inflation calculator that bad boy?
Yes, let's. $1,000 in 1930 is worth in 2018 approximately, may I have a drum roll, please, Casey?
Oh, this is gonna be crazy.
$14,593.80.
Damn!
Whenever I read a fine of that sort, you know what always grinds my gears the most? It's the change.
Yeah, come on. Insult to injury.
Just add 20 cents.
Right.
Why are you doing this?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But like you said, it did not diminish his love of the herb. A lot of these quotes are coming from excerpts from a biography that I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there was one biography where he talked very openly about his love of marijuana and, you know, his belief in marijuana law reform.
Sure.
Very openly. But this manager, that manager we talked about with
Glasser.
With the mob ties, had a lot of that stuff redacted, pulled out, because he thought it would be a bad look, I guess, for his client. And Louis Armstrong swore that he would have a sequel released that only contained the stuff about his beloved Gage. But yeah, so he got out. They pulled some strings, some of the club owners, I guess, in California and in the Los Angeles area, got him out, and he returned to the bandstand post haste. And then he said when he was performing on the bandstand, there's a quote where he says, "I laughed real hard when several movie stars came up to the bandstand while we played a dance set and told me when they heard about me getting caught with marijuana, they thought marijuana was a chick. Woo boy, that really fractured me."
Yes. This is strange because you'll hear a lot of marijuana advocates today and in more recent years describe Louis Armstrong as one of the first public policy advocates for marijuana.
Sure.
And granted, a lot of these outfits will be a little biased. Like, you can read an article that takes this stent on a website called, guess what, Noel? Marijuana.com.
Oh, wow.
By
someone had to snap up that URL.
Right. And what we also found, and what we would be remiss not to mention, is that later in life, Armstrong developed significant lung problems, and he died before he even reached his 70th birthday. You can find this in Louis Armstrong, Genius and Drugs by Stanton Peel, a PhD writing for Psychology Today. The marijuana use had to have something to do with
it. Oh, sure,
right?
Of course. Yeah. No question about it. And I want to be clear. We are certainly not advocating the use of marijuana. This is just such an interesting story, and it's obviously part of the culture, and especially when it comes to, you know, creative types and musicians. And clearly, Louis Armstrong was a highly functional, successful, creative person, and this was something he chose to do. And you can't deny that it may have had an impact on the music that he made as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely,
you know?
Yeah. There was this idea that it opened up people's improvisational chops.
Sure.
And Armstrong, when he writes about it, also mentions that there was a bit of escapism. You know, it made it easier to not feel like you lived in a country that was constantly kicking the crap out of you.
Yeah.
And we can say one of the reasons we're laughing so much about this is because Louis Armstrong's personality shines through so vibrantly and at times comedically in the interviews, in his written works. And we didn't even mention the cartoonish anti-marijuana propaganda that was around in the 20s and 30s, right? Well, a lot of it, which was race-based, primarily discriminating against people of color. So he's rebelling against an authoritarian effort, which in principle is admirable.
Absolutely. And just to clarify, some of those quotes of Louis Armstrong talking about his experiences with weed were not from that original book, which came out in 1954, called Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans, because he did talk about it in those sessions, but his manager did have those pulled out, and you cannot find them. But it was near the end of his life. In 1971, he sat down with two biographers, Max Jones and John Chilton, where he decided he was going to, quote, tell it like it was. And this comes from a fantastic article by Lisa Ruff from Leafly called Louis Armstrong and Cannabis, The Jazz Legend's Lifelong Love of the Gage. And when he sat down with these biographers, he admitted that he did eventually have to put down the Mary Jane, right? Because the penalties were just too steep for him to deal with. You know, he talks about, as it's a young man's game, you know, you're going to skirt the law and live life on the edge, but you get older and it just stops being functional.
Yeah, and he's still, my favorite part about that quote is that he's still found a playful way to refer to the substance.
You want to read this quote? It's a delight.
Sure, it'd be an honor. Well, that was my life, and I don't feel ashamed at all. Mary Warner, honey, you sure was good, and I enjoyed you heap much, but the price got a little too high to pay. At first, you was a misdemeanor, but as the years rolled on, you lost your misdue and got meaner and meaner, jailhousely speaking. So bye-bye. I'll have to put you down, dearest.
Beautiful.
Beautiful, sad, all at once.
Yeah.
It's like Kurt Vonnegut.
It really is.
Kind of writing. There's one other thing I do want to point out. I thought you would enjoy this, Noel. It has little to do with marijuana, but a lot to do with Louis Armstrong. He was an amazing trumpet player, right? And he was an amazing singer. He was a forthright advocate for marijuana. He was also a laxative advocate.
I'm sorry?
A laxative advocate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sort of like a John Harvey Kellogg kind of guy?
kind of. Hopefully not that into enemas.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he was an advocate of losing weight through laxatives, which is tremendously unhealthy. Nobody do it. But he was such a proponent of it, people would ask him how he lost so much weight because his weight would fluctuate.
Yeah.
And he was very open about it. He was like, I used laxatives.
I just pooped it all out.
And he would name a brand of it. He even wrote a book called Lose Weight the Satchmo Way.
Was he sponsored? Did he have was he sponsored by, what's a popular laxative? X-Lax. That's like a legacy brand.
Well, his initial favorite laxative was something called Pluto water.
Oh, my God.
And it was banned in 1971 because it contained lithium.
Oh, boy. So not only did it make you poop your brains out, it probably made you feel real mellow.
Yes, he was so convinced that laxatives were a great curative thing that he gave bottles of them to his friends as presents, and he also he produced flyers that depicted him sitting on a toilet, smiling.
Wow.
He told the British family when he met them during the 1956 Great Britain tour about how awesome laxatives were. True story. That's pretty fascinating. But I wanted to end on something a little upbeat because it is a shame that he was driven, you know, to say goodbye to things that he loved.
It's true. And speaking of saying goodbye, Richard Nixon himself, whether or not he served as Satchmo's drug mule, he did have some very kind words to share on the day of his passing. That was July 6th, 1971. He says, Mrs. Nixon and I share the sorrow of millions of Americans at the death of Louis Armstrong, one of the architects of an American art form, a free and individual spirit, and an artist of worldwide fame. His great talents and magnificent spirit added richness and pleasure to all our lives. And to steal a line from this really cool, but by far the most off-the-mark version of the story, but it's animated in this series called Drawn and Recorded, Louis Armstrong, Satchmo, and Nixon. You can check it out on Spotify. At the very end, it quotes this this statement from Nixon as well, and ends by saying that Richard Nixon also added richness and pleasure to Louis Armstrong's life by smuggling his gauge stash.
So. And this is just touching on a single anecdote from the strange and rich history of drugs and public policy in the United States. We could also recommend, if you'd like to learn more about the history of marijuana specifically in the United States, that you check out our friends over at Stuff You Should Know and check out the article from NPR, The Mysterious History of Marijuana by Matt Thompson, which comes via Code Switch. That's a great show.
Really, really good show.
And that's all for today, folks. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. As always, thanks to Casey Pegram, our super producer. Big thanks, maybe the first time we mentioned on the show, to Christopher Hasiotis.
Man, he is a mensch.
This guy is a top-notch researcher who's been working with us, and we're hoping that one day we can cajole him or sweet talk him into appearing on the show.
He seemed game, but yeah, we're collaborating with him on research for new episodes from here on out, which is really exciting. So look for some really cool, fun topics coming up, one of which is coming up next, where we talk about how a James Bond film essentially created a Dia de los Muertos tradition, parade, event, festival in a city where that wasn't a thing. So tune in and check it out.
Yes, and in the meantime, you can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. Also drop by Ridiculous Historians. I don't know if it'll be up by the time this comes out, but based on a previous episode, one of you, dear listeners, started a poll, and the people have spoken, so I'm going to have to post that Opryland picture.
Oh, cool!
I hope it's not underwhelming. It's from far away.
Ben, how could it be?
You can mainly see a tiny boy in a gigantic hat.
Oh, well,
but it'll
no
be
spoilers.
Up.
Yeah. I can't wait to see it. That's going to be really exciting. Did we thank Alex Williams, who composed our theme?
You know what? Even if we did, let's thank him again.
Right. He deserves it. Thanks, Alex Williams, who composed our theme. And most importantly, thanks to you for listening to another episode of Ridiculous History. Can't wait to see you next time.